One more, yeah.
One question. Something you've not touched on is the prospect of turning coal into oil, which is a technology that can happen, and they also need to go much more before it becomes economic. How does that fit into the picture?
These are the two big things I've left out.
The other probably big thing is climate change, of course, but I haven't mentioned that. No one's mentioned, well, let's do coal for liquids first. New Zealand, as you know, is thinking of turning its fairly large lignite deposits in Southland into liquids. China has been considering this. It is possible. It can be done. The infrastructure needed to put it in place is very large. And Hirsch looked at this possibility back in 1956, and he concluded that it would take 10 to 20 years to put in place a coal to liquids technology which would supply the world in oil. I didn't mention it because the environmental implications in terms of climate change would be so horrendous that just doesn't bear thinking about. If people go down that route, then, you know, give up. Go back to your farm, try and move down south, Dunedin. Actually, it's a big problem. One of the reasons I moved to Dunedin is I thought it would be a good place if climate change accelerates, but of course, if everyone wants to move down there, it's just a bit crowded.
Okay.
Yes, straitjacketing expansion and imploding cities are held out as the answer to an energy shortage, and that public transport is supposed to be energy efficient more so than cars. In fact, it isn't. More particularly, densification involves reinforced concrete and steel and aluminium, which are far more energy intensive than conventional timber housing. There are all sorts of other reasons why this implosion thing is costing us an arm and a leg and wasting a hell of a lot more energy. Are you aware of any studies which look at total energy consumption of cities under various scenarios that are done by credible authorities?
Well, I have a student who's looking at that very problem. I don't know whether he's credible yet. we'll see in the next year or two, but you're quite right. You have to look at the embodied energy of buildings, and putting in place green buildings in particular, if you do it at an accelerated rate, may in fact increase the amount of energy which we use for buildings. And at a time in life when carbon is really valuable to be not put into the atmosphere, then putting in place large green building programs may in fact exacerbate the problem. And I agree with you entirely. And as I said, I've got a student looking at it.
Any more questions? Ready?
Bob, I'm just wondering, I read in ACEEE studies by Skip Reichman and Kate Martinez that they assume about 20 to 25% of energy consumption could be quite easily and cheaply reduced just by cutting out wasteful behaviours. Do you think it's about that much in terms of
more? Probably more, probably closer to 50%. Just having a look at transport, I think we can cut that 50% of transport needs without a problem. The problem is that our economy, our GDP, is predicated on waste and conspicuous consumption. Tourism, all tourism is unnecessary. It's fun, but as far as living and surviving, it's unnecessary. You can get all of tourism, that's 10% of air traffic probably, and you can add it all up. Personally, 20-30% of transport is taking your kids around to school. I don't know if it's probably not quite as bad in Auckland, but in Dunedin, when the school holidays, the streets are all clear. Okay? Half of my life is taking my son around to soccer matches, to music practices, and so on. So all these trips could be cut out and localised very easily. This is what's happening now, and we're already doing it, because New Zealand oil supply has maintained constant for the last 6 years, but we haven't noticed any great change. So what must have been happening is some of these frivolous trips have been cancelled and energy efficiency measures have been put in place. So yeah, you're quite right. It can be done easily. And it will happen as energy gets in short supply.
One more question, then we need to wrap up. We have morning tea. Yeah.
I missed this carbon electricity, may have already talked about it, but where does nuclear power sit in this?
No, I miss nuclear as well.
It seems that that's the most obvious next step that people are certainly pushing for.
Has anyone read Storms of My Grandchildren?
Mm-hmm.
Jim Henson? Jim Hanson, Jim Hanson's the climate change fellow who says that we should get rid of all coal-fired power stations by 2030. He's got one chapter in his book saying, you know, everyone likes to give a good luck story at the end of their book or lecture when it's really depressing. And so his good luck story is nuclear. If you go the conventional route, you know, it's impossible. Okay? Again, I don't like to do sums any more complicated than I've got in my head. Okay, so remember in the first slide we had nuclear as 6% of the world energy supply. 450 reactors in the world, so let's say 5% of the world energy supply. It's an easier number. If we wanted to move the whole world to nuclear, what that means is we'd have to multiply the number of nuclear power plants by a factor of 20. Okay? That's for our present supply. So 20 times as much power stations. The present data suggests that with reasonably recoverable reserves, we've got about 100 years supply left of uranium. Okay, with conventional reactors. 100 years supply left means peak in 50 years. 50 years divided by 20 is 2.5 years. By the time you fill up all the reactors with their fuel, you'd run out of uranium. Uranium is not going to power the world energy system. It's going to contribute, 6% or 7% to world electricity, but it's not going to supply world energy. Jim Hanson realised that, of course, and so he posited the fast breeder reactor. Fast breeder reactor changes the... In conventional reactors, you only can use a very small percentage, 0.7% of uranium. It's an isotope, uranium-235. If you have a breeder reactor, you change some of the uranium to plutonium, and plutonium can be used as a fuel. And you breed your own fuel. That increases the amount of fuel you've got. Well, some people say as much as 100, but no one's ever proved it because no one's got a breeder reactor working over any length of time. The French tried it with the Super Phoenix, the Japanese have tried it, the Russians have, I think, still got one working, but almost every country has disbanded the fast breeder reactor. Fast breeder reactor, the difference between a fast breeder reactor and a conventional reactor is that it has to work very close to being an atomic bomb. The reaction times you've got to shutting it down are milliseconds. For a conventional reactor, with slow reactions and so on, it can be of the order of an hour. Okay, so if something goes wrong, like in Chernobyl, if you don't stuff up, you can shut it down. When you've got millisecond reaction times, then people can't be involved. It has to be automatic. And of course, then you've got new problems. You've got extremely high heat transfer rates. You're engineers, you know the problems. Unlikely to happen. It's possible, might not. The other possibility, of course, is fusion. And they're building a reactor in Catarache in France now, the International Fast Breeder Reactor Program. That's a possibility, but again, 100 million degrees in the reactor vessel, it's going to be very tricky. So it's unlikely. We should go for it. I don't think we should stop the program. But I wouldn't bank on it. I wouldn't bet my life on it.
Thank you, Professor, and let's everybody thank you.